Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Parents Tool Talk Radio with your host, Jody Johnston Powell, licensed social worker, certified family life educator, second generation parent educator, and author of the award-winning book, The Parents Tool Shop, The Universal Blueprint for Building a Healthy Family. For over 25 years, Jody has been training parents and family service professionals nationwide and serving as a parenting expert to the media worldwide. Now, through the Parents Tool Talk radio show and teleseminar series, Jody shares her practical advice and introduces you to other experts who can give you proven, effective advice on the issues that matter most to parents. So get ready to be informed, entertained, and enlightened as we join Jody now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Parents Tool Talk Radio. I am so glad you've joined us today. I'm Jody Johnston Powell, author of The Parents Tool Shop, and I'm your host today. And today, in honors of Mother's Day, our topic is Wisdom and Support for First-Year Moms. And I've invited a guest expert for today's discussion. And before I introduce her, I want to remind our foster parents who might be listening to check in at the beginning and the end of the show if you want to qualify for continuing education credits. So just call in or use the chat room, and the directions are at parentstooltalk.com. So let me introduce my special guest today. Dr. Wendy Middlemiss is going to be helping me answer your questions about how to raise healthy and happy infants in that all-important first year of life. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Wendy Middlemiss. Her doctorate degree is in educational psychology from Syracuse University, where she focused on parenting styles and children's competencies. She's currently an associate professor at the University of North Texas, where she teaches courses in children's development and cross-cultural parenting, including research projects in Austria and New Zealand. Previously, she was the associate professor at Penn State University, where she directed a program preparing students for work in human services agencies with a focus on family relationships and family therapy. Throughout her professional career, Dr. Middlemiss's research has included areas of family interaction and children's well-being. Specific research projects have included questions associated with infancy, including infant sleep routines and mothers and infant stress, and the importance of mothers' comfort with sleep routines as it's related to children's later social well-being. Dr. Middlemiss has completed research on parenting styles, effective approaches to parent education, and family interactions in three generational homes, where parents are parenting their adolescents who have had children. So you can see she's had quite a bit of experience and knows quite a bit about our subject of that first year and sleep, and so very interesting research. So Wendy, thanks so much for being on the call today.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, good. Before we start and dive into our discussion, because I want to hear a little bit more about your research and you, and we'll dive into our questions and information on infants, I do just want to give folks some information on how they can participate. We love it when people can participate live and call in with questions. So let me just briefly tell people how to do that. Folks, we will take calls around 20 and 40 minutes after the hour. If you want to call in with a question, then you just dial 347-205-9654, and you press the 1 button to raise your hand, and that way Chris, my producer, will see that you have a question. You can also go to the Parents Tool Talk chat room anytime during the interview, and my producer, Chris Gooley, will be monitoring the chat there, and you can just type in your question, and he'll pass that on. And to get to the chat room, you go to parentstooltalk.com, and you click the chat button near the player. So I'll give you those instructions again when we're ready to at about 20 after to take some calls. But I definitely want to get back to Dr. Wendy Middlemiss and our topic today, which is wisdom and support for first-year moms. So Wendy, how about if you just start by telling us a few words about yourself, why you chose a career in educational psychology, and how you came to kind of specialize in infant health and well-being and some of the research you've done.
Well, I guess my interest in was generally stemmed from parenting and families and how we can support children in a way that gives them an environment and context where they can excel. So I wanted to know about how children grow and how children learn and what it is that each child needs and how it differs across children or families or cultures, what might be best to provide for children. So that's what led me to educational psychology as a basis, because it allows you to look at the development of a child and how they change across time and how they grow, but also how they learn and how you teach. So it was a nice combination of subjects that provides a basis for parent education and competencies.
Very interesting. And just in general, did you find that infants cross-culture, are infants, human infants, very similar regardless of culture?
Well, their needs are fairly similar,
okay.
You know, irrespective of culture. Infants, when they're born, you know, humans are probably one of the most fragile beings when we're born. So consequently, we need a great deal of care to survive, and we need certain types of care to survive well. And that's pretty constant. And children, infants, come out, as any parent would know, remarkably capable of contributing to the building of a relationship with their parent and letting their parent know or their caregiver know what they need. And that's pretty constant across cultures. How parents provide that within a community or a culture changes. But the necessity of that doesn't change.
Okay, very interesting. Well, let's talk about that first year then of development, because it does sound like that would be very consistent and very similar, that most babies are going to go through some similar things developmentally and are going to need some similar things during that first year. So tell us, what are some of the most important things that parents need to know and be aware of during that first year?
Well, I think that there are two things. In terms of learning, kids learn mostly through their senses and their motor skills, so we have to be very attentive to what they're doing and what their state of being is. For very young infants, there's only a certain time where they're very alert. So it's very important for parents to be aware of those times and interact a good deal with their infants at that time. But socially and emotionally, which is probably the most important type of development for an infant during that first year, they just need to know that they are competent to get their environment to take care of them. And that's pretty much so what they come prepared to do. They come prepared to interact, to fuss and cry if they need something, to smile, and although they don't smile for a little bit of time, but to smile and giggle and play when they're content. So it's very important for a parent or a care provider to respond to those signals from an infant. They're doing some marvelous research where it shows that infants that are just days old will actually try to gain the attention of their parent or will imitate what a parent does as a means of providing that interaction. And when parents return, you know, so if I go, you know, make a sound of some sort as an infant and the parent looks at me and smiles and makes that same sound, even, you know, within moments of birth, days of birth, you can see how excited an infant gets from that. And that's really what they need, is that attention and that understanding that they're competent to elicit that from their environment, from their context.
I just love the terms that you're using to put within context, and I've never heard anyone quite say it the way you did. What I love about what you're saying is that the sounds and things that babies are doing, even in those first early days, they're reaching out to us as parents to engage us in a relationship.
They really are. It's very amazing to see some of the researchers that work in this area, and they do research across little seconds of time, which is probably why I don't do that research. I don't have the patience. But they can take those little interactions and actually look at them very, very clearly. And you can see when you look very closely that an infant will either imitate what the sound. So if a mom is cooing, just making cooing noises, the infant will actually try to make the same noises.
Wow.
And then the mom will make the same noises again. And they can't do it for very long, so it's very easy to miss. But they are very attuned to doing that. They you know, that care is so essential,
right,
that it isn't surprising that they come, you know, biologically prepared, that their brain is already set up to be able to do that.
Right.
So they're very smart, these little tiny babies that we have.
And I think that's a big misconception. I think people think generally that infants have no intelligence or maybe can't do that. And certainly I think it's much more common for people to view crying and certainly what people would judge to be a negative, you know, cooing and smiling, obviously, you know, oh, they're trying to reach out
isn't
to me,
cute,
you know,
yeah.
with the relationship. But I like that even the negative or what people would tend to judge negative isn't negative at all. It's just another means of trying to communicate and engage in a relationship and to establish that closeness of I have a need. And infants are very dependent, so that warmth, that acceptance, you know, that bonding, so that attachment forms is very important. Can you share some ways that parents can, because what I'm hearing is that bonding and establishing that relationship in the first year is the most important thing. So share with folks, what are some things that they can do to help with that attachment and bonding?
I think one of the, particularly because every infant is so different, it's very important for a parent to be watchful and responsive to their infant. Even if they've had an infant before, they're, you know, their second child, as most people say, when they've had more than two children, you know, the children aren't particularly alike. Children are, even infants, are very able to show you whether something's making them happy or making them unhappy simply by how they respond to what you're doing. Some infants don't like to be held quite as much as other infants, or they don't like to be held in a certain way, and so they'll get fussy. So it's very important for parents to notice those sorts of things. It's also very important for caregivers to respond to infants. Crying is really their only means of communicating that something is really very distressing. They don't have a good deal of emotional, you know, development and understanding as they will as they get older. So really they're just saying that something's really distressing me and I need your attention. It's very important, I think, for parents during that time to recognize and understand that that an infant doesn't have the capacity to be manipulative, to cry simply because they want additional attention or, you know, they cry because they really need something, whether it's just whether that they just need somebody to smile at them, they need that emotional support and comfort, or whether they you know, really have something, they're hungry or they're wet or they're, you know, uncomfortable, overtired, that crying really is a need. So it's not like with a three-year-old, you know, who may cry for many different reasons. An infant cries simply to talk to you. It's their mechanism to talk.
So that then raises the big question, can babies really be spoiled if we pick them up a lot?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
So that raises the question that a lot of people have, which is whether or not they can spoil a baby.
You can't spoil a baby. You really can't spoil a baby, you know, by picking them up too often or paying too much attention to them. You know, that sort of, you know, paying too much attention or, which is a difficult thing at any time. It's just a difference in how you pay attention. But during infancy, attending is really where you're going to construct that bond and that relationship. And it's that, and it's the comfort that infants develop with that relationship that allows them to be independent later. Because, you know, if attachment theory will tell you that, you know, the more secure I am, that you will take care of me if I feel uncomfortable or distressed or scared, the more likely I am to take risks. So if I'm, you know, if I'm secure in that feeling, then when I'm one and two, you know, I'm off doing things because I know if I'm doing things and something goes very, very wrong, that I just have to, you know, scream or cry or run to you and you will make things better. So that infant, it seems, I guess, kind of counterintuitive. The more attention I give you in that first year, the more likely you are to be able to be socially strong and, you know, independent and play by yourself and be comfortable with other kids, all that sort of, all those social skills that we want children to have. They're more likely to come from relationships where there's been a good deal of attention in that first year.
And I think you're right. I think that tends to be counterintuitive because I think what most kind of the old handed down adage of, you know, don't pick up your children. They'll be too, you know, they'll spoil and
they'll be too clingy.
They'll be clingy. And so we have to get them used to not being held, when really that just creates even more separation anxiety or more of that sense of I am alone and no one's there, and which is, leads to insecurity. So I know one of the one-liners I learned when I had my first baby was a baby's wants or a baby's needs, which kind of led to the, you know, it's okay to pick up babies, they can't be spoiled. And the other thing that I heard, and maybe you can tell me if this is true or not, I had heard that skin-to-skin touch actually helps boost brain development, that there's something about human touch. It was the whole, the do you remember the,
monkey experiment,
the real monkey and the monkey.
Yeah, Harlow's experiment with monkeys, where they could either have a wire mesh monkey with food, or they didn't want the food, they wanted the touch. Touch is, even now, if we're very, very upset, what we want, you know, which I think is important for adults to remember because it's within the framework that we have as adults. If we're very, very upset and somebody touches us, you know, whether they touch us on the arm and touch our skin there, or whether they're close enough to us and they touch our face, that is such that you can actually feel your body relax. And that's what happens with infants. That skin-to-skin contact, first of all, is very necessary for that bonding. It's very important for that sense of security. And, yes, it does help facilitate brain development, in part because of that touch and the more sensory experience that you have with that event, but also in terms of the secure bond that it helps to develop, helps the brain to communicate.
Yeah, and I found it so that need for touch is actually essential to life. And that what I had heard on that experiment with the wire mesh mom, and then there was one that was wire mesh but covered with fur, and then a real live monkey mom. I think it was monkeys, but that the baby monkey that had the real live monkey mom that would hold it and all of that thrived. The one that had the just covered with fur, it was what we would consider failure to thrive, which was it lived, but it barely survived. And the one with the wire mesh died.
The same thing happens with mice and rats. If they're not licked, you know, held by their mom and, you know, touched and licked, groomed, they don't grow.
Yeah.
So it's really that. It's touch and that interaction, that sense of care and bonding. But as humans, we are extremely social. And we need that bond.
Yeah. And even giving children that attention, even if they're not demanding it. I can remember one of my first jobs out of college is I was a caseworker, and this situation made such an impression on me. I went in to do a home visit to a mom who had a new baby, and the baby was sitting in a little pumpkin seat, a little like a child carrier, just so quiet and was such a good baby. And I visited with the mom for, gosh, maybe an hour, and she talked about how good the baby was, and she just sits there and is so quiet. And never once during this, and now remember, I'm right out of college, so I've never had kids, and I'm the youngest. I've never even been around babies. So I'm thinking this is, you know, what a great, you know, child, and the baby's so quiet. And I get back, and I'm sharing with my supervisor, and how long did you meet with her? Oh, for about an hour. Did she ever pick up the baby? Well, now that you mention it, no. And the baby never cried? No. And I'm thinking this means it's a good baby. And my supervisor says, Jody, that's not good.
Yeah, no, that's not good.
This baby's gotten used to never being held, and she's given up.
Right. She has. And that's very clear in those studies I was talking about before. Infants will try, and they will try, and they will try so hard. And it's actually painful to watch in situations where there is no response. And eventually they will just completely shut down. Because it's, you know, that's a behavioral response. You know, we don't continue to seek out a response that's not going to be there. It's just an extinction. It's what happens with little babies in orphanages. It's what happens, you know, with moms that are depressed and can't interact well with their children.
Yeah. And actually, and we probably, again, I know we're getting close to our 20-minute break where we're going to check and see if people have questions before we dive into other questions. But maybe if we have time at the end, maybe we can come back to this, because you just mentioned something, and because I do a lot of trainings for foster parents, one of the issues that a lot of foster and adoptive parents have been facing is reactive attachment disorder, which basic is a child who was unable to have those attachments and the long-term effect that that has on them. And we could probably do an entire hour just on that. And I don't know how much expertise you have, but maybe just say maybe 30 seconds to a minute, something about that, and then maybe if we have time at the end, we could come back and explore it further if you want.
Sure. Sure. You know, just in general, you have to be very cautious and slow to develop an attachment and to allow the child to provide continued opportunities for that child to seek you out, but never to intrude. Being intrusive is equally as off-putting to infants and to children. So to provide that opportunity and not to be annoyed or unhappy when they don't respond, but just to continually let your reach, however you're reaching out, let that reaching out always be constantly there in a loving manner until that child feels safe and secure enough to reach out back. And then just to take even that slowly. So it's just a slow process, but one that you know you can initiate, but they're really the ones who are the drivers of it. You have to allow them the opportunity to feel comfortable in initiating how much contact and how much attention there is.
Yeah. So what are, in a brief answer, what are the long-term consequences if that attachment doesn't occur? Say it is maybe one of those orphanages where maybe a child just lays there and is not touched day after day. What kind of long-term, in a nutshell, kind of consequences might there be?
Well, you know, the attachment theory will tell us that forms our internal working model, our sense of how important others treat us or respond to our needs. And we can learn that there are times or people or life is going to provide for our needs, but there's always that underlying discomfort and mistrust of the likelihood that other people are going to attend to our needs.
Okay, good, which would just carry on throughout life.
Right.
Yeah.
In one
okay.
manner or another.
Because that first year, a lot of wiring is going on, and that's part of the wiring, isn't it?
It is part of the wiring. And then what we have to do is learn that things can be different. But it's a learning. It's not an innate sense.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we can come back to that. I know we're right at about 20 minutes, and I do want to check and see if we have any callers and take a little station break. Wendy, feel free to get a sip of water if you want. Let me take just a quick few minutes to welcome those of you who may have just joined the show. This is Parents Tool Talk, and I'm your host, Jody Johnston Powell of the Parents Tool Shop. And today we're talking with Dr. Wendy Middlemiss, who's an associate professor of educational psychology at the University of North Texas. And today we're talking about infants and infant-parent interactions to try to provide some wisdom and support for first-year moms, kind of in honor of Mother's Day, which is coming up this weekend. So we're going to open up the phone lines at this point. I'm going to check and see with Chris, my producer, if we have either callers or chat folks who are interested in asking Wendy any questions. If you are interested in asking a question, there's two ways you can do it. You can either dial 347-205-9654. After you hear the prompt, you can press the one key, and that raises your hand so that Chris knows that we have a question, and our producer can get that. And if you're in the chat room, you just go to parentstooltalk.com, you click on the chat button, and you can just type in your question there, and Chris will pass it on. So I'm going to have Chris go give you guys a chance to call in and have Chris go check for those callers. In the meantime, I'm just going to make a couple of announcements while he's checking for that and let everybody know about the Parents Tool Talk mailing list. This is a list that if you sign up for it, you're going to get access to this month's post-show resources, and we'll be telling you about those at the 40-minute break, what those are. Being on that list also gives you information about upcoming shows, more details on how to download the recordings, how to get CEUs, continuing education credits, if you're a foster parent, and some professionals can get those, how to subscribe to an RSS feed, and more. So it's a list where you get exclusive information that we don't send out to just everybody. It's special discounts and special resources just for our listeners. So I want you to know that it's a special list that doesn't automatically put you on any other list. I never sell or give away your information. So it's just kind of the lifeline so that we can give special resources to our listeners. So if you want to sign up for that, just go to parentstoolshop.com/tele. That's www.parents, with an S, toolshop, all one word, www.facebook.com/TELE. So, Chris, do we have any callers or chat questions at this point?
Hi, Jody. We have a couple of people in the chat room. No questions at this time, so I think we should hand it back to you and Wendy to just keep going with what you're talking about today.
That's fine, because I had a whole list that I told Wendy I wanted to talk about, so I'm just full of questions myself. So we'll have another round of questions about 40 minutes past the hour, and I know Wendy still has some valuable information to share, so let's go ahead and get back to our conversation and shift gears just slightly and talk about some of the common challenges or issues that arise for new moms during that first year. We've talked a little bit about development and attachment and a little bit about crying and being clingy, but I noticed that one of the big areas of research that you've done is around infant sleep. So let's kind of shift gears and talk a little bit about sleep, because I think that's a really big – parents have a lot of questions, I think, about when their baby should be sleeping through the night, if they're not sleeping enough, or if they're waking – if they're sleeping too much, or if they're waking up too much. I think either experience can lead to questions. I know my producer Chris and I were talking about this and we're sharing stories. Chris, do you feel comfortable sharing the story you shared with me? Do you want to jump in with your story?
Hi there. Sorry about that. didn't unmute quite quickly enough. Yeah, sure. I have an older sister, and we share the same mom, different dads. When my sister was born, I don't know much about how she was, particularly the first night when she came home after being born, but apparently my mom was prepared for me to be up all night the night that I was born, so she stayed up all night waiting for me to wake up. But apparently I was the one who slept straight through the night, and my mom was the one who didn't get any sleep at all.
Well, hopefully she slept the second night.
Yeah.
I'm sure she did.
That was a quick learning curve.
That's right. Oh, he's sleeping.
Right. And I know I had two very different experiences. My second child, actually, she was 2 weeks early. And those first 2 weeks, it was like she didn't know she had been born. Like she was still in the womb. And she just kept on sleeping. I mean, we could hardly even wake her up to nurse. We're all ready to interact with this baby, and she's just sleeping on us. And then my first child, however, he was a real good sleeper. You know, he was 2 weeks late, so he was like, I think he was practically ready to walk when he came out. But he slept through the night until he cut his first tooth, and then he did not sleep through the night again until he was completely through teething. So sleep time became a real, you know, and getting him to sleep through the night, and he was clingy and the crying, and, you know, that was a real difficult phase. So I've kind of had two extremes on that. So share with us, you know, some of those questions, like when should children be sleeping through the night? How do we know if they're sleeping enough? You know, those kinds of things.
Well, I think first there are a number of things just in how both you and Chris have discussed sleep that help to give us a context to talk about infant sleeping. One is that you used the word phase. It wasn't, you know, a difficult phase. I think one of the most important things for parents to realize is that particularly with how their infants sleep, it is just a phase. And sometimes it's a phase that's defined by something that has to do with sleeping, and most times it's not. It's a developmental sort of thing. But infants aren't too particularly consistent in how they sleep across that first year. You know, some seem to be sleeping, you know, longer periods and then shorter periods. And, you know, then once they're toddlers and they can walk, they do all sorts of different things. And don't stay in bed again. But you know, so that's one thing, is that most things are a phase. And infants who are sleeping, you know, fewer hours or waking up more often at one point in that first year are not, you know, based on research that's shown, any more or less likely to be the infants who, you know, don't sleep particularly well as toddlers or the infants who don't sleep very well in middle school. Adolescents just physiologically don't sleep well, but that's a whole other story. But
that's another
show. We won't even go there. Just suffice it to say, they don't. But you know, and that's one. And then was a good sleeper. I think was a phrase both of you used. And we have a real misconception overall on you know, sleeping like a baby and a good sleeper. Infants aren't really supposed to sleep well. It's really and we don't hear much about the average infant and how they sleep, but we hear an awful lot about the, you know, proportion of infants who sleep longer hours, you know, on average in comparison to others. But most infants, particularly in the first 4 months, are just developing a sleep cycle in their circadian rhythm. And to remember, they came from someplace that was completely dark, pretty consistently, hopefully. And so they develop in that first 4 month sleep cycles and a circadian rhythm. And when they first are born, on average, most infants will wake and sleep and wake and sleep and wake and sleep pretty consistently through the day. Sometimes in 2 hour, you know, spans of time, sometimes in four. So it's the unusual baby that comes home and sleeps through the night. So Chris, your mom had it right. you had it wrong, but that's okay. She appreciated that in the long run. But
she was right to be confused.
That's right. You know, so, and particularly if an infant is breastfeeding, you know, breast milk, because it is so easily digested, and such a good nutritional resource for infants, they can digest it very quickly. So they become hungry quickly again. So they will wake up more often. Infants also aren't necessarily supposed to sleep for long and extended periods of time because the mechanism for waking up isn't as well developed. The whole neurological system that supports sleep and breathing during sleep and all sorts of different things is one of the last things in humans to develop well. So it's really some believe protective for infants to have a lighter pattern of sleep. And in many instances, they will have a lighter pattern of sleep, and so they will wake up more readily. So that's, you know, so it's important, I think, for parents to realize that there isn't, that they should be cautious about some of the terms that we use that set up expectations that are going to be hard to reach. For instance, sleeping through the night, or, you know, defining poor sleep as waking up often, and needing and wanting attention, because those are all defined by different things. And then very often, between 4 and 6 months, a baby will start sleeping better in terms of longer hours, if we want to define that as better. I always try not to, but, you know, they'll sleep more hours, you know, within that nighttime framework. And then at 6 months, they reach that point, their first point of separation anxiety. So you'll have a baby who has slept fairly long hours or has, which means they've slept, woken up, and put themselves back to sleep, because none of us sleeps, you know, through the night. But they've been very good at being able to put themselves back to sleep. Well, all of a sudden wake up and feel much less secure about waking up alone and going back to sleep. So they will call for attention, which is crying, and want attention and comfort before they go back to sleep. So that will be the first time where you'll see another real change for most babies. In their sleep patterns. And then when they can walk, it's just all over, because they wake up in the middle of the night and it's dark and they're alone and it's like, well, I can solve this.
Yeah.
And so they go and they find mom. But, you know, so I think my overall message in terms of the pattern of sleep is that it's very variable. Everything's a phase. You know, if you're very, very upset about something, it's probably just going to change in a little bit of time. In some ways, the more responsive you are to difficulties that infants have at night, the more quickly they go away. You know, babies who are picked up and held when they cry at night cry for less and are awake less time, so they get back to sleep more readily, even though you've been up. So, it's, you know, it's a real mixed bag, and I think we need, you know, as parents, sometimes we're best off keeping that firmly in mind. And that person next to you on the playground who says, oh, my baby is sleeping through the night, you know, in a week's time, they may not be. So you don't have to do that. You really don't know what'll happen.
Yeah. Well, and you've mentioned several things, I think, that if we can go back, if you could explore a little bit further, because you've mentioned when they go to bed and how can you share some suggestions for, are there particular things that are better maybe for parents to do in terms of how they put a child down, where they put them down, what they do. And I know that it sounds as though that may change because you said that 6 month where the anxiety comes in and they wake up, and that may change. So I've heard people reference, well, we started a bad habit around bedtime. So talk a little bit about what parents can do that would be some good habits, some good practices to do around bedtime, and tell us if any of those have to change, like the first 6 months versus the second.
Well, I think one of the things that's most important in looking at that is that, two things, actually. One is to follow the infant's lead. Some infants really want a lot of attention at bedtime, or they want to be held until they're asleep and put down. Other infants are much less likely to want that. So they're very comfortable with, you know, being put down when they're mostly asleep, or not being held to go to sleep. So one of them is, it's another time where it's very important in building that relationship with your child to notice what it is your child wants, because it can be very different. The other is that a sleep routine and what you do around sleep really depends upon what you identify as, a mix between what I've just spoke about, what the baby needs, and what you want as a family, or what you're expecting based on your background or what your culture does. If you hold a baby until the baby falls asleep, they may well want attention in the night when they wake up, and then go quickly back to sleep with that attention. If you identify that as something that you're comfortable with and the baby is comfortable with, then that's certainly an appropriate sleep routine for you and your family. If you're really much more of the mind that your infant needs to sleep and be able to resettle themselves in the nighttime for whatever reason, whether it's that that's how you need sleep, and waking up in the middle of the night, for some it's very easy and for others it's very difficult. So for whatever reason you decide that that's something you would like your baby to be better able to do, then there are ways to structure your nighttime by that will encourage that type of sleep for your child. It isn't necessary to have your child cry for extended periods of time to learn to fall asleep. Some theories would suggest that that's very similar to the baby in the little pumpkin seat that you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
that I'm not crying in the middle of the night, not because I'm not unhappy or distressed, because as you noted, your supervisor said, well, that's not a good thing. So I may be very quiet in the middle of the night, but it might not be because I'm very comfortable with that as a process. But you can encourage longer periods of sleep with your infant dependent upon how you put them to bed. You can extend the periods of time. You can wake them up. One of the best ways to do it, if you don't want your infant to cry and you want them to sleep longer periods of time, is to wake them up right before the time that they would normally wake up, and then do whatever, feed them if you need to feed them or change them, and then put them back down. And then you extend that period of time where you wake them up. And then they will sleep longer hours, but they haven't had to cry to do so.
Wow. Good suggestion. And I know on the back end of that, when I work with parents around toddlers and, children, older children who get up, and that whole let them cry it out approach, there was an approach that you were supposed to wait longer and longer and longer, and when I tried this with my older child, not only did he get he's hysterical, I'm sitting in the other room crying, I'm starting to, get all, because it's going on into like 45 minutes, an hour, he's starting to hyperventilate, throw up, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking, this cannot be good for any of us. And so I tweaked that, and it's very similar to what you just said, but it's that you let children know you're going to come check on them, and you check on them regularly, so maybe you would do it every 5 minutes, and when they handle the 5 minutes okay, then you increase it so that they're not having to get out of bed or call for you or cry for you to come and check on them, and it kind of conditions them to wait longer and longer.
Right.
But they know there's that security there that they know that you're going to come check on them.
And that's, and that's an essential component of what you need to do, is to provide that sense that I know mom is there, and I know that she's going to listen. Some people will just say to sit in the room and sit with the child if they're older, or rub their back if they're younger, so that you're not really interacting with them, but they but they learn to have that comfort. And then you do that, you know, at longer periods of time in between, but you come back. There are all sorts of mechanisms to provide for that, as you're saying, without having those long periods of distress. Mm-hmm. For a toddler, it's not a good thing, but for different reasons. But for an infant, it's just a very precarious thing to do. We spend so much time advising parents to be attentive during the day and then providing that opportunity for parents to be completely inattentive at night. And I'm very hard-pressed to see that as the best approach when there are other approaches that can get to the same end.
Mm-hmm. And so the key there being that there's no one right way, and that if we are in tune with what our child needs, and are paying attention to this particular child and their sleep needs and how much they like touched and all of that, if we're aware that we have different options, then we can use those. And as you said, during the infant years is different than toddlers and older children. Different factors come into play, and that's where I'll tell people about that over the break, which we're getting ready to come up on, of tips for when it's not infants. You're covering the infant sleep, and it's a whole nother ballgame once they're older. And I have a resource for that. To wrap up the sleep conversation, before we go on our 40-minute break, can you share with us, I know that in a lot of cultures, sleeping as a family or, quote, family bed is a practice. In America, it tends not to be. I think it's controversial because there are some safety issues, but yet there are some benefits, some clear benefits in terms of touch and bonding and things like that, but yet there's this benefit versus danger kind of issue. Can you just maybe in a nutshell address that? What's your stand in terms of family beds and what you tell parents around that?
I think that the most important issue is, the two things we've talked about before, what's appropriate for the family, what the baby seems to need, and then the issue that you bring up, and that's of safety. There are very safe ways to engage in a family bed to sleep with your child, and they're very unsafe ways. And it's similar, that there are very unsafe things that you can do in a crib and very safe things that you can do for an infant in a crib. So if you're going to have a family bed, there are some things that you need to make sure of. And one is that one is that you don't smoke, either the mother or the father, because that will increase the risk of SIDS if you smoke and you sleep with your baby. So if you smoke, then you either have to stop, or not co-sleep. But other than that, the bedding has to be appropriate. The surface has to be free of things that the child can become entangled in. It's dangerous for children to sleep with their siblings or to sleep with a parent on a couch or in a chair. Ironically, I never did this research before. When my one child was an infant, and what I would do is I would sleep with him, and then I would get up, sit in a chair, and nurse him and fall asleep, which is the most dangerous thing that you can do. And then when we were both, asleep, I would walk us back to bed. But that would be not a good thing. So infant sleep is just not necessarily, there are ways to make it a safe environment, whether it's a solitary sleeping situation or not. The advantages, the American Academy of American Pediatricians will tell you that proximity is very important, to be able to be close enough to keep an eye on your infant, because sometimes they will stop breathing during the night, and obviously you want to be close enough to notice that. If you are co-sleeping, some of the physiological advantages are that the moms and the babies breathing, or the adult and the baby's breathing, becomes synchronized, and that synchronicity will, if the baby stops breathing, will either awaken the mom, because it's a change that you're much more aware of than you would think you would be, or the mom's breathing kind of jumpstarts the baby's nervous system, so they start to breathe again. So, it is a very controversial issue, but it can be a very safe environment as long as the parent is aware of what needs to occur for that to be a safe environment.
Yeah, and the other two safety factors, I appreciate all of the extra, because you've actually mentioned a few that I haven't mentioned when I kind of talk about this. But if someone is a deep sleeper, or if they're using drugs, alcohol, medications that would cause them to be a deep sleeper. So those would also be kind of some risk factors. So
Times where you would not to. And and people who are extremely obese.
Yeah, that's a good point too. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take a quick break again. Again, Wendy, get a drink here. It's about a quarter till. I do want to give a chance if anybody does have questions for them to do that. I always have tons of questions ready for our guests, and I know I've still got a whole list to talk to Wendy about. But let's do a real quick break here for our last set of announcements. And people who have just joined us, let's welcome them and let you know it's Parents Tool Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Jody Johnston-Powell of Parents Tool Shop. Today we're talking with Wendy Middlemiss, who is a doctor and is Associate Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of North Texas. And we're talking about infant care and trying to provide some wisdom and support for first-year moms in honor of Mother's Day. And so I'm going to have my producer check out whether or not we have any callers or whether or not there's any chats. And while he's doing that, I wanted to mention two resources that I am going to provide. One is going to be part of our post-call resources, and I think I told you about getting on our list earlier. I'll tell you a bit about that again in just a second here. And then also a resource that I happened to think of and mention while Wendy was talking. Generally speaking, and those of you who know me, my book is The Parents Tool Shop, and it mostly focuses on parenting children ages 1 to 18. And I specifically say 1 to 18 because I do know that first year is very, very different and unique, and that's why I wanted to have Wendy come on and have us do a focus on that first year. I do have a couple of sections on infant development and behavior and some of the common challenges, so I'm going to offer these excerpts of the Parents Tool Shop book as a post-show resource today for those people who are on our Parents Tool Talk Radio mailing list. I've actually had dozens of requests this week from parent educators nationwide for a similar excerpt on the full age range. So I know it has a lot of really valuable information in it. So again, to get on the list where you can get these post-call resources, you're going to want to go to parentstoolshop.com/tele, T-E-L-E. Parents with an S, toolshop.com/tele, and sign up for the mailing list. And those post-call resources will go out shortly after the call ends at the top of the hour. Chris, do you want to make the announcement about our featured resource of the month? I kind of referenced it a little bit earlier, but why don't you make that announcement and let us know if we have any questions when you're done.
Sure, Jody. Well, listeners, you might have noticed that one of the topics Jody and Wendy have been talking about is bedtime. And since this is the case, our featured resource this month is the Halting Bedtime Hassles Teleseminar Resource Package. And that includes a recording, a transcript, and suggestions for how to get kids to bed, asleep, and staying there through the night, including step-by-step instructions for resolving the top 10 bedtime hassles that parents face. You can order that or just get more information on it at www.parentstoolshop.com/tele. That's the same web address that Jody gave you earlier. But then also add another /, and the word bedtime. So that's parentstoolshop.com/TELE and /bedtime. And now I'll hand things back over to you, Jody and Wendy, because we are still just listening on. No questions at this point.
Okay, great. And let me just add that website that you gave, that all of the everything that comes after those /, is in lowercase letters, and it does matter. It is case sensitive. So
yes, that's very true.
Yeah. So TELE and bedtime are all lowercase. All right. Well, Wendy, we've got until about 5 minutes till. At that point, we'll have to start doing some wrap-up, but we still have a bit of time. And we've talked about infant bonding, development, crying. We've just spent a whole section on bedtime and sleep issues. So let's kind of hit on a couple of more a little bit quicker. We spent quite a bit of time on those. You had mentioned breastfeeding and the breastfed babies, because breast milk is so easily digested that they may wake up more often in relation to sleep. Let's kind of take that as a lead-in, because I think they're just the whole issue of feeding and, when should moms breastfeed and how long and is my baby getting enough, all of those kinds of things. just share a little bit about what parents would need to know during that first year around food issues and feeding.
Okay, well, with breastfeeding, if you feed on demand and feed until the baby's done, it's likely that the baby will be getting enough breast milk. It's such a fascinating capacity to that it's a feedback system where when the baby eats breast milk, then the body will create more. If they eat more, it creates more, and so that's a very nice thing. And the breast milk is so important itself to the baby and to the baby's growth. It helps the brain development in ways the formula really can't recreate. So there's so much brain development that goes on in that first year that it's an essential building block to the neurons and such. It also provides the immune response of the mom to anything that the baby may catch. So that's very good. The challenges, of course, are that particularly for moms that are returning to work, expressing milk so that they continue to make milk. They need to express milk during the day, and finding the time to be able to do that, and then keeping that milk cool, so that they can, even if they're taking their child to daycare, they can take those bottles of breast milk to daycare, and then the baby can continue to breastfeed even if the mom has to work. That's a real challenge for women, and some women are much better at expressing milk and that whole process than others. Breastfeeding can be, there are times where breastfeeding can be a real challenge for a mom. There are times when it can be painful, if I remember correctly, but that's usually for a reason, and if that's happened to a mother, she needs to go back into her obstetrician and find out how she can help with that. Breastfeeding itself is something really to continue throughout that first year to help with the infant's development. I think that's the current recommendation of American Academy of Pediatrics. But even breastfeeding beyond that time, although not as readily accepted in our culture as it is in other cultures, is a very important thing. So that's just nutritionally and in terms of the body's physical development. But as you point out, that skin-to-skin contact and the time to look at and interact with your infant is something that's very essential to that growth. It's most moms who breastfeed will remember or will know that almost the instant that the baby if the baby's crying, the instant that they touch the mom's breast, they will stop crying and fussing. So there's an abundance of positive aspects to breastfeeding, both for the mom and for the baby.
Okay, good. And also, I have to have another resource to share with folks who are breastfeeding, is that a lot of hospitals, WIC, which is Women, Infant, Children, there's a lot of lactation consultants who specialize in assisting moms around feeding issues. It isn't always breastfeeding. It's also bottle feeding. But a lot of them have great expertise that if you are running into a problem around breastfeeding, a lactation consultant, there's a support group called La Leche League that's it's international. And that's more mom-to-mom support, although the leaders of those do have education. It goes through repeats an educational series. And then there's additional support around breastfeeding. So again, if it is a natural process, so if you do run into problems, there's a reason for it, which is kind of repeating what you had said, Wendy. And mm-hmm. So if you investigate that rather than just giving it up, usually most of those problems can be worked through. For a final question, because we're getting kind of down to just the last maybe one or two minutes here, talk with us a bit about colic, because I think it between the sleep and the food, kind of combine those together, and something that can happen during that first year that can be very distressing and frustrating for parents is a baby that has colic. And I think there's, at least in the past, it's been unclear some of the causes, and so maybe share with us what you're aware of in terms of most recent information around what causes colic and what parents can do. My daughter had colic, and she at about 4 o'clock in the at about 9 o'clock at night on the dot, she would start screaming and she wouldn't stop till four.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for almost 6 months, which I've been told is an extremely long period of time.
That
normally doesn't last that long. It was really difficult. And so we had about 10 to 12 different things that we would do, from movement things to soft cuddling things. And we would kind of rotate and just see whatever worked. And sometimes nothing really worked, and we would just trade off because we would either get exhausted or I would start crying and get so frustrated. So we just, and even my son, you know, he was four at the time, and there would be things, you know, that he would, you know, pat her back or whatever.
Mm-hmm,
so
right.
Share with us, actually we're at our last 5 minutes, so this will be the last answer. So about colic.
Well, I think that that there are a lot of important elements in what you described. What you did was to continue to respond. It was your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You continued to respond to your daughter and to provide that comfort. There isn't a clear indication of why colic occurs. It's very interesting that there are countries in which there is no colic and they don't even have a word for colic.
Huh.
You know, which may suggest that in some to some extent there's something contextual or environmental within, you know, how we respond to babies that may contribute.
Mm.
Babies that are constantly carried around in slings and such, usually don't, those are the countries where there really isn't a word for colic. But and that may be because they cry and they're being carried, so it's not a problem, so it's not defined as a problem. But that gets back to what you were doing. You continue to respond, and I think that's an important component of how to deal with an infant who has colic. However, the other part of what you were saying is that's a very stressful type of interaction. So a parent really needs to have other resources so that there's just a period of time that they deal with, that they're interacting with the baby and providing comfort, because it is very difficult to provide comfort when it doesn't seem, to continue to provide comfort when it doesn't seem to be helping,
mm-hmm.
because that's a very frustrating feeling, and it can make parents feel very incompetent. So I think it's very important for parents to realize that even if it doesn't seem to be helping, that their interaction with a child is very essential,
yeah.
and that skin-to-skin contact is another thing that's going to be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
My son would cry, but just for a very, brief period, for like half an hour, and we would just sit on top of the dryer, and there was the noise, there was the heat, there was the, and then we would walk around as a train, but we would, similar to you, provide interaction and comfort during that time, even though it didn't seem to visibly to the care provider be helpful. But it is essential. It's probably very essential to the outcome of how the baby will experience that.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good. We're just down to our last couple of minutes, and so I'm going to shift gears here and lead into kind of our wrap-up and some of our final announcements. So let me do a quick recap that our guest today has been Wendy Middlemiss, and we've been talking about wisdom and support for first-year moms. So, Wendy, you've really given us lots of practical information and lots of insights, and so thank you very much for coming on with us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Good. Let me mention one more time, our featured resource this month is the Halting Bedtime Hassles Teleseminar Resource Package. And you'll get a recording, a transcript. You can get that at parentstoolshop.com/tele/bedtime. If you want to sign up for the excerpts from the Parents Toolshop book on infant development, you can get that at parentstoolshop.com/tele and sign up for our mailing list. And again, that's T-E-L-E. Foster parents, remember to send a chat message and to check out from the call, and that way we'll know that you can get CEUs for your participation in the call today. So thanks again, Wendy, for joining us. We really learned
welcome.
A lot.
Oh, thank you.
Great. And thanks, everyone, for listening and joining us today on Parents Tool Talk. I'm Jody Johnston-Powell. My website is www.parentstoolshop.com. And I hope you can join us again next month for a very special program. It'll be designed for dads in honor of Father's Day. So I wish you all a great Mother's Day weekend and a great month to follow. And we will talk to you next time.